No, we're not going to talk about nationhood. That is a sad and trivial affair. As I just finished telling Jim Duff, it's disappointing that what was done in Parliament, it may have been politically astute, but it's disappointing. It's time that truth was talked to the people of Quebec, that we began to recognize that there was no great injustice done to some kind of native people. The French imperialists who came here for beaver pelts and killed the Indians and were then conquered by the English imperialists who killed the French and the Indians and gave a third of the country to the Hudson's Bay Company. This was an economic experiment, this country of ours. And it didn't come to maturity until both French and English and immigrant bled at Vimy Ridge and later at Dieppe and Normandy and on and on and on. Nobody's got a right to reverse that simply because they want to make a political future for themselves. It's time some national voice was heard that said that. The whole sovereignty movement was started by, mostly, by ex-federal bureaucrats who couldn't find a place for themselves in the system and created this myth. So no, we're not going to talk about the sad issue of nationhood because this day is more important than that. And there are more important issues out there. And it's time that Canadians and Quebecers particularly got over their narrow-mindedness and their low limitations and began to recognize that. We're going to talk first tonight about the anniversary and what this day is, and I hope many of you remember it. I want to hear from a lot of you. 22nd of November is an important date. Today is the 43rd anniversary of the assassination of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy. That tragedy haunts us still. In many ways and at all times. The writer Mary McGrory said on that day that we shall never smile again. Daniel Patrick Moynihan said, no, we may smile again, but we'll never be young again. For most, it was the day hope died. But hope, like courage, rests not on the shoulders of any one man, but lives on from the words of that man in the hearts of all. All we need is the resolve to remember and to carry on. It is in that remembrance that we answer the question of many scholars as to what JFK's legacy really was. His presidency too short to see the fulfillment of many of his boldest initiatives. How is it that he captures our imagination still? The answer rests in his words as much as his deeds. For those words, those ideas, still make us see possibilities in ourselves that we thought unimaginable. They held out the vision of a generosity of spirit that could realize the ancient dream of the brotherhood of man. They challenged us to vigorous service and sacrifice in our daily lives, and most of all, they dared us to be brave. They lit the flame of courage within each of us that made us all understand that the indomitable spirit of freedom shall triumph over the dark forces of tyranny. Perhaps that is the greatest quality of leadership, to make people bolder, braver, better than they ever thought possible, and to give them hope, the greatest gift. At no time since his murder has the world been in need of such hope and such courage. It is for that reason that his words resonate with us still. At no time since the Second World War have the free been so full of fear. At no time since that era has appeasement of terror and villainy been so obsequious. Kennedy understood these dangers well in his 1940 best-selling book, Why England Slept. He wrote, "It is an unfortunate fact that we can secure peace only by preparing for war. Today, history repeats itself. A continent rests, as Bruce Bauer has so thoughtfully examined, and while Europe slept, a radical Islam is destroying the West from within. New cloaks for the old tyrannies." The greatest tribute to John Fitzgerald Kennedy is that his words and vision, during his one brief shining moment with us, remain relevant as calls of conscience for us today. And if we don't answer those calls, if we don't respond to conscience, then years from now people will ask how it came to be that the family of free people so willingly went complicit in its own destruction. For today, on this sad anniversary, we've just witnessed the British Prime Minister do a total about-face in the Middle East by demonstrating the most ignominious surrender to political correctness on Al Jazeera, the radical Arab world's main propaganda platform. In France, teacher Robert Redeker is still in hiding from death threats for the past several months for daring to publish an op-ed in Le Figaro, in which he decried Islamist intimidation of freedom of thought and expression in the West. Le Figaro's editor also appeared on Al Jazeera to apologize for publishing Redeker's article. In the Netherlands, the two strongest voices in Holland warning against Islamic subversion of Dutch culture and society, Pim Fortuyn and Theo van Gogh, were murdered. The third most prominent voice, calling for the Dutch to take measures to defend themselves. Former member of Parliament Ayaan Hirsi Ali, herself a Muslim, moved to Washington. Though the European Human Rights Convention stipulated that states must enable free speech, Anne-Marie Thomason, a former Dutch judge at the European Human Rights Court in Strasbourg, stated that the limits to freedom of speech in the European context lie where the expressed opinions and statements affect the human dignity of another person. The message? One can't say or write anything one wants if somehow it offends anyone. Melanie Phillips, the author of Londonistan, noted at the Freedom Center conference that what Europe is witnessing is a dialogue of the demented, in her words. In this dialogue, European Islamists protest victimization at the hands of the native Europeans while threatening to kill them. And native Europeans have to apologize for upsetting the Muslim radicals and loudly criticize the U.S. and Israel for, in Dylan Thomas's words, not going gently into that good night. In the meantime, jihadist ideologues and political leaders are flourishing throughout the continent. Some governments have even aired Muslim Brotherhood members, have even hired some Muslim Brotherhood members, some 30,000 of whom have been summarily jailed in Egypt by President Mubarak, as counterterrorism advisors. There could be no more poignant day to remind us all that submission is not a strategy against global jihadist domination. During Kennedy's presidency, Europe faced a threat of similar magnitude, though of different origin. And Kennedy went to Berlin to address that threat and send a message to those enemies of freedom. And on a glorious sunny June day in 1963, almost 5 months of the day before his murder, he delivered his famous Ich bin ein Berliner address in the Rudolfwaldplatz facing the recently constructed Berlin Wall. The words, just some of the words of that address, are the most fitting tribute to Kennedy's legacy. And few words could be more important lessons for our own national will, for his words remain timeless unto today. Freedom is indivisible, he said. When one man is enslaved, all are not free. And I hear it said that West Berlin is militarily untenable, and so was Bastogne, and so in fact was Stalingrad. Any place of danger is tenable if men, brave men, will make it so. And that is what we have to remember as we seek a national vision, and as we seek to rally our own resolve in what are the true crucial issues of today. We'll be right back. And as I said before, at the beginning of my tribute to on this 43rd anniversary of the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, I want to hear from you out there. What do you remember? Where were you? I know where I was. Even though I was a kid, I remember every moment of the day. And before we get to our guests tonight and our issues tonight, let's go to the phones and start it off there. Brian from Lachine, how are you?
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I was thinking about your long spiel about freedoms and the fact that we have what we call freedom. So the thing is, when you look at the art we have nowadays, it does express a certain condition we have. I guess we're suffering from a state of, you know, like we all feel lonely. But when John F. Kennedy died, that was a moment of loneliness for a lot of people.
Yes.
And naturally, I felt that at some point, I said, you know, wasn't it nice that John F. Kennedy founded the Peace Corps, which was like a good thing, you know, for the world, and peace was a good thing. And it still is. But getting back to art, the other day I was in an art store, and I saw a poster taken, painted by an unknown painter. You know, you're familiar with art stores and stuff. Mm-hmm. They sell prints, they sell reproductions. Now, this art store happened to assume that the painter was a genius or whatever because they made this life-size National Geographical poster, and it showed a refugee behind barbed wire. Now, there's a symbolism because the refugee was wearing, you know, something, a headscarf or something. And I thought to myself, I said, if you could take any poster from any magazine and represent, you know, some condition of the human beings, you know, because this really did represent a state of the rest of the world, you know, that they're sitting behind barbed wire. They could be in Darfur. It could be anywhere. I would say that, not getting too far away, I'd say our art has changed from the time of Kennedy, because a lot of the art in the old 60s or whatever seemed to be much, much lighter. And, you know, magazine covers actually had a lot of pictures.
I think what you're talking about,
It had a lot of pictures of John F. Kennedy.
Brian, I think what you're talking about is one word that I used in the long introduction, and that's hope. It was still a time of hope, and his death was a time of sadness, but for many people...
Well, it was also a time of loneliness.
It was also a great alienation and a loss of hope. Brian, we got to go, but thank you for your call. Kennedy, in that famous speech on that day in Berlin, besides talking about what was defensible and what was not, and reminding everyone, the naysayers and the appeasers who were saying that West Berlin was untenable, reminding us that so was Bastogne and so indeed was Stalingrad. But everything is tenable if brave people make it so. Also said in that speech that 2,000 years ago the proudest boast was Civis Romanus Sum. Citizen of Rome, the day in the world of freedom. He said, the proudest boast is Ich bin ein Berliner. I don't know what the proudest boast will be in our world today. But I know that one proud boast is that our first guest I can call friend, and he gives me some hope. General Lewis McKenzie, thanks for taking time to be with us.
Hey, pleasure, Beryl.
Lou McKenzie, you wrote "Go big, go bold, and get it done." As far as the Afghanistan missions, do we have any will? Do we understand that what went wrong was not enough commitment, not enough brave men, as Kennedy would have said?
Can I take 1 minute and just tell you what I was doing when I heard
you? Absolutely,
because it was somewhat unique. I guess we're all unique, but the fact is, I was in the Gaza Strip. And we had just had a staff car with two soldiers in it go underneath a camel, of all things,
Jeez.
Lift the roof off the car, and they were decapitated. And by the time we got there, they'd been pretty well robbed blind by some Bedouin folks.
My God!
And so we came back and got a 40-ouncer, which cost about $1.50 in those days, in my room, and sat there. And then we turned on the short wave and heard that Kennedy had been assassinated. The compelling part of the story, I think, is the impact it had in the Gaza Strip, the world's most densely populated area, mm-hmm. in 1962-63. And I mean, it just went into mourning, because I heard you referring, as I was listening in, to the aspect of hope. And I mean, there was a chunk of the world a long way away with people living in refugee camps early on, the UN sort of caretaking of them, which has turned in to be a bit of a problematic situation. But nevertheless, I mean, they just went into total mourning. A few years later, I've got a British company in Libya, for God's sake, on desert warfare training. I took them to Tobruk. This is when Idris was the king of Libya.
Right.
Took them into the theater, and halfway through the movie, it stopped. And I went out to the guy running the projector and said, "What the heck's going on?" He said, "Well, Kennedy's been assassinated." I said, "No, come on, deja vu. I was here years ago when that happened." And he said, no, Kennedy." And he stopped the movie, not telling me it was Bobby.
Right.
All that to say that I think we do, under the current leadership, we have a very stretched military. They're not complaining because they believe in the mission. They are standing up to be counted along with a few others, like the Brits and the Dutch, etc. But I'm fearful for the future of NATO. I mean, it didn't have to do much other than provide deterrence for over 50 years, and it did that really well. I was with them for 9 of those years over in Germany, waiting for the Soviet hordes to come over the East German border. But the fact is that now people are being selective. It's as if the Article 5, which calls us all to come to the defense of any or all those that are attacked, is some sort of multiple choice where governments decide whether they're going to participate or not. It just blows me away that some have said, no, we're not going to show up altogether, and other countries say, we'll show up, but we're not going to fight, or we'll show up and we don't go out at night, type of thing. What kind of alliance? And quite frankly, I was putting a lot of faith in NATO as being the preeminent alliance to take on the bad guys, and I'd love to see it go in and kick ass in Darfur and Khartoum, for example. But nevertheless, it's sort of not living up to its hype.
Lou McKenzie, please stay with us. We're going to a short break. We'll be right back.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking to General Lewis McKenzie. I really recommend his piece in The Globe today, Go Big, Go Bold, and Get It Done, because it doesn't just relate to Afghanistan. It relates to what the West is all about today. Lou, you said you were worried about NATO. General David Richards, the commander of NATO forces in Afghanistan, is making such a meager request, 2,500 more soldiers. Is it not the problem today, as opposed to the man whose anniversary of his assassination we think about today, is it not the problem today that political leadership goes stop and go, stop and go, stop and start, and the military men who know what it takes to get it done are just being used as yo-yos?
Well, like it or not, within the democratic system, we respond to our political leadership, which wouldn't bother me in some cases if the political leadership was knowledgeable of what was going on. And I'm delighted to say that at present it appears that's the case with our current government. At least they've taken the effort to go there, have a look, be briefed, and listen to briefings as to what we're achieving, what we, the international community, is achieving. But there are other nations, it would appear, that, God bless the Dutch who are there with us. Even they took 3 or 4 months to come to a conclusion that, yes, they would come on down south and get involved in the scrap. So It's decision by committee, and you and I both know
that doesn't work.
Probably the best bloody example of that, decision by committee, where some people have more influence than others, or vetoes in the case of the Security Council, you just don't get anything other than the lowest common denominator coming out the other end, and then they hand it to a commander. And I'm not whining and complaining for commanders. I'd love to be one again. But the fact is that all of a sudden the commander gets the mission, and then everybody dumps on him or her when it doesn't go well. I mean, Richards needs a doubling of the size of his force, because what will happen now, if he does, all of a sudden, let's say the Germans and the French and everybody removes their caveats, and he's able to bring them down and have them join in the fight in the southern three provinces, the Taliban will move in behind the areas that they vacate up around Kabul. So you need boots on the ground to replace them. But for a commander to look down his list of resources and have to check the caveat to see what the restrictions are, how he can use them, it just must be driving him crazy.
You know, the sad thing is, in this introduction on Kennedy that I read at the beginning, this is an article I wrote called JFK's Legacy to Rouse a World from Fear. Sometimes leadership needs nothing more than will, determination, and words. Mm-hmm. There was a story about during John Kennedy's presidency when one of his advisors came to him and said, you're telling Americans that things are bad and negative and your poll numbers are dropping and you really should adjust, much like politicians do today, focus groups, polling. And he said, if I have to adjust the message of what I believe, I don't want to lead a people like that. We don't have political leaders, for the most part, like that anymore. Everything is running between the raindrops. How does the future look in a world like that?
Well, it leaves the door open for someone who is takes a leadership position. In the case of Harper at present, for example, there are a phenomenal number of people that disagree with what he's doing.
Yes.
However, there's a grudging respect out there. It was the same with me and Trudeau. I mean, as far as I was concerned, Prime Minister Trudeau, rest his soul, was on the wrong side of the two major events of the 20th century, Nazism and communism.
Yep.
Nevertheless, at least I admired the fact that he didn't compromise his principles. He expressed himself and stood up for what he believed in, even if I happened to disagree
right.
with a lot of it. And so, that's leadership. It's not a bloody popularity contest. You have to have the conviction and the belief that what you're doing is right. And if the people give you a mandate, then and they're going to terminate that mandate, 3 or 4 years from now, then fine. But at least do what you believe in.
Lou, you've got to take another short break, and please stay with us through it. I just want to ask you a few final questions
mm-hmm.
with the Brits,
sure.
As opposed to the Dutch. Montreal will be right back with General Lou McKenzie. And star 940 for Roger cell phone users, pound 940 for Bell cell phone users. Today is the 43rd anniversary of the assassination of President John Kennedy, and we want to hear from you if you have any memories of where you were, what that lack of leadership has meant to the world since those years. And I'm proud to be talking to one of the few leaders that we have in this country right now, General Louis McKenzie, about Afghanistan and our mission there. Lou, before the break, we were talking about, you had mentioned the Dutch at least willing to come in. Tony Blair in Al Jazeera the other day, who sort of did a complete about face, why in Al Jazeera, God knows, it's political pandering, he's not running anymore. And he seemed to completely almost do a, if not a 180 degree turn, a 120 degree turn, and put the whole thing back into the Arab-Israeli dispute. What happened over there? Did that shock you at all? Did that surprise you?
Yeah, a little surprising, although, let's face it, Tony's carving out a role in a competitive arena between the French and the Germans and himself. So.
Yeah, but he's gone. He's not running again. He put himself next to the Americans on these missions.
I think he's patriotic. I think he's strongly about his country. I got that feeling from him. I was never a great... Well, in the beginning, I wasn't a fan. My wife was, but I wasn't. But he's sort of grown on me. He does have a tendency to, and it's not just because he supports us and supports the U.S., he stands up and makes a pretty articulate case, much more so than our friends south of the border, but does a pretty good selling job, and maybe a bit of an epiphany. He's had, on the road to Damascus, maybe he's beginning to not be quite so constrained by what the polls are saying, etc.
Or is he trying to carve out a role for himself as a sort of the British Jimmy Carter after he leaves office?
Yeah, there you go.
Be all things to all people. How did you arrive at the number of 30,000 that you say is needed in Afghanistan?
Well, I took a look at how many are inside the wire. That's the expression
right.
the troops use, and that's not a derogatory term. I realize that national headquarters and logistics and hospitals, et cetera, are required. In fact, the most dangerous work over there right now is the platoon of about 35 inside the wire that goes outside the wire every day escorting logistics convoys, because we don't have airlift, mm-hmm. and therefore we have to deliver fuel and food and ammunition by road convoy, which is extremely dangerous. And then I looked at the leave policy, where people are actually leaving the theater, overlapping with those that are coming back from leave, so you've got to reduce about 15-20% of the force that way. Then I looked at the terrain and the scale, the size of the province that even Canadians are looking after, and I'm just shaking my head thinking, you know, this is unbelievable. You've got to have, in fact, where the Canadians are, a way more than twice as many, but if you doubled the size of the force, NATO force, from 30 to 60,000, then there are a lot of areas that wouldn't require a doubling in size, and therefore you could come down to the three southern provinces with the Brits and Dutch and Canadians.
You anticipated my next question.
Yeah.
Something's always bothered me about the way the Afghanistan mission is being explained to the Canadian people. Afghanistan, the Afghani leadership, the political leadership, are not like the Iraqi leadership. I've met them. They're sophisticated. They're being successful. Mm-hmm. Canadians are really nation-building over there. We like nation-building. How come we're not being... It's not being explained that Afghanistan or the Afghani leadership is not like Iraq, and as you point out in your piece... There's fighting, yes, but there's fighting in 3 of 34 provinces. You know, so the Italian contingent is the 2,000s in the westernmost province, which is basically calm and peaceful. Why can't that message get out, that this is working, this is something that's working?
I don't know. It seems that so many people have their mind made up and they just aren't prepared to listen. I mean, we're talking, and I don't want to sound like some sort of show for the government, but we're talking hundreds and hundreds of schools. We're talking over 2,000 kilometers of road. We're talking 3 million refugees that have come back across an international border in and around Kabul. It went from 700,000 to almost 4 million now, as far as population goes. So they didn't come home because they were scared. They came home because they felt a little bit safer coming back into...
Yeah, you've got 70% of Afghani girls going to school now instead of getting acid thrown in their faces.
But we have an area in the south, which if we could all carve it off and put a barbed wire fence around it, we'd probably prefer to do that, because the opium trade, because there's a lot of irrigation down there, is so successful that becomes a serious problem.
And I want to bring this up again. The only reason we got stuck with the mission is because the Martin government wouldn't take the other missions, and there was nothing left except that.
Yeah, and in addition, I don't think there was a reluctance. I think probably, and if I was in charge of our military recommending to the government, I would have recommended that we go down there and kick some butt, too, just because somebody...
Oh, there shouldn't have been a reluctance, but everybody's asking why.
Yeah.
There's the why.
Well, I mean, how many times have you heard that this mission in Afghanistan started as a peacekeeping mission, when in actual fact it started with my old regiment, 3 PPCLI, reporting to Kandahar as one-third of the combat power of the American brigade right after 9/11.
Right.
It took us 2 months to get there, mind you, because we had to charter a ship, but nevertheless, we were there before any other ally was there in those numbers, assisting our Americans. And then 6 months later, after the friendly fire incident, Kretchen said, gee, I can't find 600 to replace the PPCLI. I'm bringing them home. Then magically, when President Bush came sniffing around for support for Iraq, we found 2,000 to send back to Kabul in sort of a constabulary role. Nevertheless, people were killed. We had suicide bombing attacks. So we've never had a peacekeeping role there. We certainly have a nation-building role. We've got a very influential group of highly qualified senior officers right inside Karzai's building.
Right.
That are advising and doing an outstanding job. Canada has an extremely high profile in Afghanistan, and quite frankly, a complacent nation that we have the luxury of being here in Canada is having its bills paid by a lot of young Canadian men and women, averaging probably around 23, 24 years of age, and God bless them, they're doing fantastic work.
Well, Lou McKenzie, you know, I said JFK's major legacy was to rouse the world from fear, and with voices such as yours, maybe this country will be roused from lethargy and fear. Thanks very much for spending time with us.
Cheers, Beryl. My pleasure. Have a good one.
Cheers, Lou.
Bye.
We'll be right back after this break with your calls. And as we're dealing with the great issues on the international agenda tonight, we remember that this is the 43rd anniversary of the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. And through all our discussions with our special guest tonight, we want to hear from you. Any special memories you have, any special feelings you have about what the loss of that president meant to the world. And before we go to our next guest, let's talk to Anne. Good evening, Anne.
Good evening, Beryl. What memories this, what emotion these memories evoke, I must tell you. I was only 7, and I remember the announcement in the school, and the teachers were crying, and everybody was, it was like we were sent home. And I think, hello, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, I'm sorry, I have a static. What I think is what was lost was not only a hope, but a loss of innocence. I think that people were shaken to the core. We needed, people need to have something to, someone strong, someone who has courage of conviction. And because, you know, we all have a lot of good in us, and we all, you know, are striving to be better. The human condition now is suffering. We are in a very depleted
state. It seems that since Kennedy, people, political leaders don't understand the power of words and the power of giving courage to their populations. Just that alone, it's not always about legislation.
No.
Just giving them the generosity of spirit to be brave, to be better with each other.
How can you legislate hope? How, when you pull the rug out the next day out from under millions of people. I mean, we're on a roller coaster, and just look at Winston Churchill.
Marshaled the English language and took it out to war.
Well, you know, and you need to be strong, and like I like what you said about President Kennedy when the polls were down a bit, and they said, well, you'll have to make some adjustments. And he said, no. He said, if I'm going to start doing that, I'm going to lose a sense of very sense
I'd
of
rather,
who I am.
I'd rather not lead these people. And thank you very
thank
much.
You. I
and
love I, your show.
Thanks very much.
Goodbye.
Well, one thing that many people think we've lost since those the assassination of John Kennedy and the assassination that followed, that ended with the assassination of his brother in 68 and followed the assassination of Martin Luther King, is clarity and candor and courage in our public debate. And we've had a growth of NGOs, non-governmental organizations, because there's been such a cynicism about government. And one of the most effective in this country for rallying people to a standard that, though bloodied, is still strong, is the Canadian Coalition for Democracies. And our next guest, Francois Hachem, is the Director of Lebanese Affairs for the Canadian Coalition for Democracies. And they have released a very strong statement on what they think Canada should do about the Pierre Jamayel assassination in Lebanon against Syria, Iran, Hezbollah, and the Palestinians. And it's a very, very, very clear program. They're calling for a cancellation of our active trade partnership with Syria, as was done with South Africa during apartheid. They're calling for the Lebanese Immigration Office to be moved back to Lebanon from Syria. They're talking about ending our funding for UNRWA for its incitement of Palestinians against Christians in Lebanon. And they're calling for a forceful move to bring to justice the killers of Rafik of Hariri and Pierre Jamayel. And we're pleased to be joined now with by Francois Hachem from Toronto. Good evening, Francois. Thanks for taking the time.
Good evening, Bill. Thanks for having me.
I've heard, excuse me, from sources of mine in the Middle East that this assassination of Pierre Jamayel has very swiftly divided the country. In other words, Nasrallah and Hezbollah and other Shiite groups like Amal, headed by Nabi Berri, who've made their coalition with Michel Aoun, the Syrian Orthodox leader, the former general, in the south, and in the north, an alliance of the followers of Rafik Hariri, the moderate Sunnis, the Druze, and the Maronite Christians. If that's true, will anything that the international community do save this country?
Well, the division in reality happened when they refused to implement 1559.
Yes.
That division existed back then. When 1559 came to birth from United Nations, basically, automatically, that division appeared and happened because pro-Syrian, anti-Syrian. The Syrian, they have lost their presence in Lebanon because of 1559. And the Prime Minister, the late Prime Minister Hariri, had paid the price for it. He was the first victim on that, you know. So the division, was was done back then. And the killing machine, the killing Syrian machine, still exists in Lebanon. The executions from time to time, as we heard, assassination after one assassination. Any person who's seeking freedom and believing in democracy, democratic country, and the good values is paying the price, because yet Syria to pay the price for all this damage. With their gangsters, of course, because they still exist in Lebanon. the Syrian military had left Lebanon as far as only military customs,
right.
But their intelligence is still in Lebanon. They still exist through Hezbollah, through a lot of Palestinians' organizations in Lebanon. And they're continuing passing weapons and arming all their gangsters in Lebanon, for sure, for this type of executions.
Francois, we're just going to take a short break, and when we come back, I want to talk about three of the four points that the Canadian coalition has called for that Canada can do right away.
Mm-hmm.
Montreal will be right back. And we're speaking with Francois Hachem, the Director of Lebanese Affairs for the Canadian Coalition for Democracy, that have called for four specific points for the Canadian government to take against Syria, particularly following the assassination of Pierre Jamayel in Lebanon. And, Francois, three of these things we could really do. I mean, Stephen Harper has shown a bold vision in foreign policy. He's done it when he called for the arrest of Saeed Mortazawi, the Iranian prosecutor who was involved in the killing of Zahra Kazemi. He showed it at the Francophonie when he insisted on balanced resolutions. How active will the CCD be in advocating these three measures to our government? Ending the active trade partnership with Syria, moving our Lebanese immigration office back to Lebanon from Syria, and ending our funding of UNRWA for its incitement of Palestinians against Christians in Lebanon.
Yes. Well, we keep pushing. Our job is basically to voice ourselves very clear to our government and keep pushing for that, you know. I mean, it's unfair to preach about democratic values and not to act and support who's seeking the freedom and the democratic values, and supporting, on the other hand, the murderers and the anti-democratic values and the like the government of Syria. I mean, why we still have partnership trade with them? I mean, how many resolutions have been done so far since the last 2 years alone against the Syrian government? It's clear that they are basically a killing machine. All their act is basically based on terrorists.
And we have a particular Canadian connection or Canadian beef to have with Syria. In addition to the general humanitarian problems with Syria, but in the past several years, four Canadian Syrian citizens have been taken by the Syrians and kept in jail and tortured.
That's correct.
And we have done nothing.
Yes. I mean, that's the regime act. I mean, this is how this regime been built, is torturing their own people and torturing, have no mercy on nobody, basically their way or the killing machine. I mean, Syria, the Baathists in Syria, that's how they build their strength, based on terrorizing their own people and the rest of the world. I mean, they're trying it again, and time had never showed them that they will be punished for that.
Syria hasn't even recognized officially the international border with Lebanon. Syria basically still considers Lebanon part of greater Syria.
Well, basically, that's their ambition, basically, is to swallow up Lebanon. I mean, they have occupied Lebanon for 30 years. They had interfered in Lebanon. Prior to that, they have interfered. They're the one who orchestrated the war in Lebanon. They're the one who armed the Palestinians in Lebanon, which were just refugee camps. They're the one who trained the Palestinians in Syria to fight in Lebanon and to create all these massacres against the Christians in Lebanon. They're the one today who's training every single gangsters in the Middle East, from Hamas to Hezbollah to the Muslim Brothers and so many organizations, the jihadists and you name it. They're the one who's seeding the hate and orchestrating all the trouble in Iraq, you know what I mean? And the same thing in Israel. I mean, they're the one who's obstructing if there is any hope of peace between Israel and the Palestinians, or any hope for the birth of a Palestinian state side by side with Israel, they're the one who's trying to obstruct any peace basically creating Hamas and supporting Hamas, training the jihadists in Palestine, in the Palestinian territory, and the same thing in Lebanon. I mean, they have created so many gangsters in Lebanon just to obstruct anything to do with 1559 or anything to do with peaceful country as Lebanon used to be.
You have an intimate knowledge of Lebanon. There's one question that keeps coming up about the assassination of Pierre Jamayel. We know that his grandfather, of course, founded the The Christian Falange, we know that his uncle Bashir was president and was assassinated. But Pierre Gemayel, even though he was an opponent of Syria, was a relatively youthful minister. He wasn't. It wasn't like the assassination of Rafik Hariri, around whom the whole country was coalescing. Was this just a sign that they could do whatever they wanted to do to whomever they wanted to do it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And he was very, well, actually...
he was leaving a church when he was killed.
Exactly. He was actually coming out from a funeral, attending a funeral, and on his way out, and that's when he got assassinated. Hezbollah today is unoccupied in the south. They eliminate this frontiers for them. And I believe that, and this is, of course, this is my personal belief, mm-hmm. I believe that they are today's, their mission is to basically obstruct any peaceful means for the recent government, elected government, to conduct any good changes for the country. And basically their just their job is to execute any Syrian wish list in Lebanon.
François Hachem, Director of Lebanese Affairs for the Canadian Coalition for Democracies, we wish you all good fortune. And we wish you all our support at the Institute, to you and to Al Gordon, and you and Naresh Raghubir. You know that you can call on our help at any time.
Thank you.
Montreal, we leave you with this thought on this sad 43rd anniversary of the assassination of John Kennedy. It's sad because of the hope in these words. John Kennedy said that we in the West are still the people of the free. And that, in the last analysis, is going to make the difference. For peace does not rest in charters and covenants alone. It lies in the hearts and minds of all people. And in this world, no act, no pact, no treaty, no organization can hope to preserve it without the support and the wholehearted commitment of all people. And we hope that the memories of today marshal the resolve of Canadians to continue our involvement in the transcendent yearnings of mankind's struggles for redemptive change. We wish you a good evening. Thank you to Nick Mason, Master Control. We'll be back with you tomorrow night.